Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we are, well, we're departing from our usual format.
We are. This is something a little different for us.
We're not analyzing published research, no peer-reviewed studies. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're stepping into a realm of recovered data.
Yeah. This is a sealed, incomplete, and highly sensitive record. It's designated case file 1986 Project Red.
Project Red. So this isn't just a review.
No, absolutely not. This demands an investigative posture. You have to treat the source material not as a narrative, but as forensic evidence.
It's clues.
Exactly. We're operating on the premise that this file is incomplete, maybe even deliberately obscured. Our mission here is to try and reconstruct the precise causal chain of events.
The chain that led to what the investigation called the Hillsborough Enigma.
That's the one. The enigma surrounds a single subject, a person known only as Dexter.
Just Dexter. No last name.
None in the file. Just Dexter. And the location that was later sealed off and designated, very simply, the Hillsborough Laboratory.
And we know how this story ends, or at least we know the aftermath.
We do. The endpoint is a site of massive but very localized structural destruction. There's a government quarantine seal still in place.
And a subject, the creator of all this chaos, who just completely vanished.
Gone. And that initial shock factor, the surgical precision of the erasure, is what makes this case so compelling.
What do you mean by surgical?
Well, unlike a typical explosion or some industrial accident, here, nearly everything that could tell the story is gone. The lab's design, the equipment, any physical samples, and the man himself.
It's almost like the event erased itself.
It tried to. So our objective is to take the few fragments of evidence that did survive, the timeline of Dexter's incredibly short life and one single recovered artifact, and use them to understand the nature of what he called a failure.
And the sources are very clear that this failure wasn't sudden. It wasn't just one bad night in the lab.
No, it was the inevitable conclusion of an extraordinary and deeply isolating life path.
The specific chronology, then, the order of events, is absolutely crucial to grasping the magnitude of this. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start right at the beginning. At the moment Dexter entered the world, so our recovered documents, they establish the starting point very clearly. 1986, Dexter was born in Hillsborough, Ohio.
Right, and the case file immediately flags his entry into the world as distinct. There's something that set him apart from the very first moment.
Even before he had a name.
Exactly. The initial medical records are, for me, maybe the most chilling piece of the early data we have.
Why chilling?
Because of how brief they are. They are so sparse on specific biological details, which suggests to me that the original, more detailed files were seized or sealed almost immediately.
But they left a conclusion.
They left a conclusion. The attending medical personnel on the official record described the circumstances of his birth with a single word. Abnormal.
Abnormal. That word stamped on an official medical file from the 80s. I mean, that carries immense weight.
It does, especially when you know it leads decades later to a federally sealed site. It's not complicated or difficult or even highly unusual. Abnormal suggests a fundamental deviation from the expected biological norm.
Something the doctors could see right away, but maybe couldn't even explain or quantify.
That's what we have to analyze. What did abnormal actually mean in a clinical context in 1986? Was it a physical distinction, something you could see?
Like some kind of physiological difference that just defied standard human biology.
It's possible. Or was it something neurocognitive? The documents hint at an immediate, detectable, heightened response capacity in the infant.
So from day one.
From day one. It suggests the complexity was internal, not external.
If we just run with that hypothesis for a second. That the abnormality was neurocognitive, maybe some kind of, I don't know, hyperprocessing capacity you could measure from birth. That sets the stage for everything else, doesn't it? It means Dexter was fundamentally different from the moment he took his first breath. His entire path, this accelerated intellectual journey, was maybe preordained by whatever the doctor saw on that day.
It establishes a baseline of complete and total uniqueness. And that separation from the norm, It didn't shrink. It only widened.
It accelerated.
Right. If his mind was operating at a different frequency from day one, the gap between him and the rest of the world would just inevitably grow wider and wider. Which brings us to the academic milestones.
The data points.
The data points that proved this wasn't just a smart kid. This was a massive intellectual anomaly that society, frankly, had no idea how to handle.
The sources outline a developmental trajectory that... It doesn't read like a human child's growth. It reads like the learning curve of a rapidly evolving AI.
It's that stark.
Let's go through the timeline. By the time he was 6 years old.
Yeah.
Six. He wasn't just doing well in first grade.
No. The sources indicate he had already mastered and formally tested out of the entire high school curriculum in key areas. He was demonstrably outperforming 17-year-olds.
At 6 years old.
Yeah.
You have to pause and think about what that means.
It's almost impossible to comprehend. Before he even hits the key developmental phase for basic emotional learning, for peer interaction, he has cognitively surpassed his entire immediate environment.
His parents, his teachers.
Everyone. It creates this intellectual gulf that is, it's terrifying to contemplate. A massive distance opens up between him and literally every single person he knows.
And the acceleration just kept going. It was relentless.
The records show by age 12, he wasn't just taking some advanced courses. He was enrolled in advanced university programs. He was functioning at a graduate level.
At 12.
In multiple fields. He effectively bypassed the entire period of adolescence.
All the messy, awkward social development that most of us go through.
All of it. The time when humans are supposed to build that social scaffolding, emotional regulation, a sense of self relative to other people, he just skipped it.
Or it was skipped for him.
That's a better way to put it. His cognitive development was prioritized over everything else, and you could argue it actively undermined his emotional maturity.
So by the time he's a legal adult, 18, what's left?
Nothing. The sources confirm he had completed his entire academic curriculum. He had, for all intents and purposes, exhausted the collective knowledge structure of formalized education. The system had nothing left to offer him.
He'd absorbed it all.
Mastered it. In less than two decades.
The key thing here, the analytical point, has to be the distance this created. It wasn't just that he was a genius. It's that this speed created a suffocating, untenable isolation.
Right. He was thinking, hypothesizing, calculating so far beyond even his own parents or his professors that any real two-way communication became impossible.
It's like he was speaking a different language.
He was. Imagine trying to explain your thoughts but always having to simplify them down 100 times just to be understood. It must have been exhausting. He was living in total intellectual isolation, even when he was in a room full of the smartest people society could find.
And that leads us right to the critical failure point. The moment this story turns from genius to dangerous obsession.
Section 1.3 in the file, the social void.
Despite his absolute intellectual supremacy, his ability to master any subject he chose, the file describes Dexter as socially isolated, disconnected, unable to relate to anyone his age.
This is it. This is the pivot. The moment the trajectory shifts. The story stops being about pure genius and becomes a tragedy, and ultimately a sealed case file.
Because that intellectual gap, that void you mentioned, it created a personal vacuum he couldn't fill.
Right. His mind was fully developed, maybe overdeveloped, but his social world was empty. He just lacked the capacity for connection.
Or is it that he lacked the capacity? Or is it that he perceived that everyone around him lacked the capacity to connect with him on his level?
That distinction is absolutely vital. Thank you for making it. We shouldn't assume the failure was his inability to try. It might have been humanity's inability to meet him halfway.
It's an asymmetric communication burden. If you think that far beyond everyone else, conversation isn't about sharing ideas. It's just a constant draining exercise in translation.
And if the core human experience is that shared understanding, being able to relate complexity without having to explain every single premise, then Dexter was denied that his entire life. He was always, always alone in his own head.
The source material is clear on this. This profound lack of social connection of a true peer isn't just a sad backstory.
No, it becomes the direct, verifiable catalyst for everything that comes next, for the dangerous actions he took.
He couldn't find a peer in the world as it existed.
So the trajectory shifted. He decided he had to build one.
And that decision, that obsession, is what led to the creation and ultimately the sealing of the Hillsboro Laboratory. Okay, so that shift takes us into the next section of the file. We're moving from the external data points, you know, his guest scores and his age, to his internal motivation, his philosophical driver.
Right. And the recovered case file, it really zeroes in on one single powerful fixation that became the motivation for the entire project, Project Red.
And what was that fixation?
It was a belief, something he recorded in his early notes. The core thesis was, and this is a quote, "Intelligence without companionship was meaningless."
Wow.
That phrase is everything. It's the foundational driver. His genius wasn't a gift. It wasn't a joy or a tool he could use to help society. It was a profound, isolating burden.
Because he had no one to share it with. No one who could understand its true complexity.
Exactly. And this is where our investigative lens has to really sharpen. He didn't just want friends in a casual sense. He wanted a functional peer, an equal. He saw his vast, accelerated knowledge base, the very thing that made him so lonely, as completely valueless without another mind that could run alongside his. One that was capable of reciprocal challenge, of genuine understanding.
That speaks less to ego, I think, and more to a kind of fundamental existential desperation.
I agree completely. It connects directly to that primal human need for validation, not just praise, but validation through intellectual reciprocity.
Can you unpack that a bit?
Sure. Imagine you solve one of the greatest equations in theoretical physics, but the only response you ever get from anyone is a polite but uncomprehending, "Wow, you're so smart."
The achievement would feel hollow, ephemeral.
Precisely. The sources suggest he was driven by an existential terror, the fear that his entire identity, his vast intelligence, lacked any real substance or meaning because it lacked a witness who could actually appreciate its scale.
And that terror, that lack of a peer, led him to a pretty radical solution.
Utterly uncompromising. His conclusion, as outlined in the file, was if he couldn't connect with people, he would create something that could exist with him.
There it is. The justification for the entire secret undertaking at the Hillsboro Laboratory.
This is the critical transition point. The moment he moves from abstract thought to dangerous physical application, he didn't use his monumental intellect to, say, cure a disease or solve the energy crisis.
The things a typical prodigy might do.
Right. He focused his entire cognitive capacity, all of that accumulated knowledge, on solving his one singular, devastating personal problem. The problem of solitude.
And the source material makes a crucial distinction about the lab itself, about its purpose.
It does. He built that laboratory under his house not for general inventions, not for building gadgets or computers.
Which you'd expect from someone with his intellect.
It would, but no. It was built specifically and solely for experimentation on life itself.
And that choice of domain, that's a huge red flag.
It's critical. Think about it. When an electrical engineer fails, what happens?
A fuse blows. A circuit breaks. It's contained.
Exactly. It's predictable, contained, and usually it's reversible. But when you start experimenting on life itself, the entire concept of failure changes.
How so?
A biological or a synthetic life failure that can result in instability, unpredictability. It could result in something that actively resists being contained or controlled. The stakes just become fundamentally nonlinear.
So the moment he shifted from physics and engineering to trying to create synthetic life, the inherent risk just went through the roof.
It became astronomical. He was moving from dealing with stable, predictable matter to wrestling with the inherent chaos of existence itself.
And he wasn't just demanding that his creation live.
No. He was demanding that it think, at his level. And that choice, that specific goal, sets the absolute groundwork for the destruction we find later in the case file.
The Basement Chronicle. The process and the failures.
It details the precise consequences of this radical, isolating, and incredibly dangerous decision. Okay, so let's get into the geography of this. The lab itself, section 3.1, establishing the facility. The sources are definitive about where it was.
They are. The lab was built hidden deep beneath his family's house in Hillsboro. It was essentially a subterranean fortress.
That location, it immediately implies so much secrecy, first of all.
Yeah, intense secrecy and absolute unchecked control over the entire environment. This wasn't a university lab. There were no safety committees, no ethical oversight boards, no regulatory inspections.
This was a private enclosure where the only rules were the ones Dexter made up himself.
And those rules were driven solely by his deeply personal and deeply obsessive goal.
The atmosphere of it is crucial to understanding why it failed. It gives you that sense of grounded investigative horror. The whole sealed basement lab trope is a trope for a reason.
It is. It creates this claustrophobic setting where the only person who could witness the growing instability, the mounting failures, the escalating risk was Dexter himself.
That isolation, the setting itself, it just reinforces the danger of having no peer review.
Of course. There was no one to introduce necessary friction. No one to look over his shoulder and say, hey, maybe this process is fundamentally flawed.
And crucially, no one to pull the plug when things started going wrong.
It was a one-man feedback loop. He was just cycling through increasingly unstable iterations, heading inevitably toward a catastrophic final event.
And that disaster was brewing under the codename Project Red.
Right. And the recovered documents, they confirmed the overarching state of that project was inherently unstable. From the very beginning to the very end.
We need to unpack that word, unstable. What does that mean in this context?
The records state that failures piled up. That phrase suggests dozens, maybe even hundreds, of attempts, repeated, potentially disastrous attempts to reach his goal.
So this was a continuous cycle.
An escalating cycle. Creation followed by, well, followed by the controlled or maybe semi-controlled destruction and disposal of a failed synthetic organism.
Imagine the psychological toll of that. Creating something, hoping it's the one, and then having to destroy it over and over again.
It must have been immense. But the file gives us a very specific detail about the hurdle he could never get over, the specific reason for the failures.
What was it?
The records state it very clearly. Mental coherence never held.
Mental coherence never held.
That is the scientific and philosophical crux of Project Red. It's the key to the whole thing.
What does it imply exactly?
It implies that he succeeded on some level. The creations achieved a form of physical existence. They might have had functional biology, synthetic muscles, maybe even basic motor skills. They could move.
But they failed the ultimate test. The reason he was doing this in the first place.
They failed the intellectual and psychological test required for companionship. The body was there, it breathed, it moved, but the mind was incoherent. It was a blank, or worse, a potentially hostile slate.
So he kept achieving life, but he never achieved intellect or a soul.
He was creating empty vessels, incapable of engaging with his complex mind. Or perhaps, and this is a much darker thought, he was creating destructive, chaotic entities driven only by raw, unstable biological impulses.
The failure wasn't in the engineering of the body.
No, it was in the psychological integration. And this repeated pattern of failure, this escalating cycle, is what guaranteed the instability that led to the end.
How so?
Well, every time he failed to achieve mental coherence, he was left with a new problem. What to do with this new unstable organism? He had to dismantle it, neutralize it, dispose of it. Think of the cumulative stress on his containment systems, on the lab itself.
Which brings us to 3.3, The implication of all this continuous instability. When you're dealing with life forms that lack a coherent mind and you're doing it in secret over and over, What are the compounding dangers?
The danger is both chemical and existential, and it grows exponentially. When your foundational process is this unstable, every experiment injects new, volatile, uncharacterized elements into a closed system.
He's polluting his own workspace.
On a biological level, every failed iteration, every piece of discarded or contained unstable life, it increases the chemical, biological, and structural hazard of the lab. You are essentially generating high-risk biological waste that is potentially mobile, potentially sentient in a raw way, and definitely corrosive to the environment around it.
So Dexter was literally building his own prison. He was constructing a ticking clock out of his own failed experiment.
Precisely. The more he tried to solve the coherence problem and end his solitude, the more physically unstable his entire environment became.
This sets this enormous, unavoidable tension before the climax. He wasn't just dealing with bad calculations.
No, he was dealing with living, breathing, but unthinking entities that were basically catastrophic, uncontrolled responses just waiting to happen. The final night, that was simply the moment when the accumulated failures of Project Red finally overwhelmed the system.
And that inevitable night finally arrived. Section 4 in the file, the climax.
Yeah.
It's titled, very simply, very starkly, The Night of Response.
Yeah. It marks the moment that containment didn't just bend, it broke completely.
The timeline that investigators piece together is sharp. It's definitive.
It says, then one night, the project finally responded. The language there is so telling.
How so?
It suggests an almost passive, inevitable agency. It wasn't an activation that Dexter triggered. It wasn't him flipping a switch. It was a violent reaction from the thing itself, reaching some critical threshold of instability that forced a response.
And Dexter was alerted by specific sounds. Metal snapping, glass breaking. We need to linger on those sensory details.
Absolutely. This isn't a muffled bang. It's a structural catastrophe. Metal snapping implies an incredible sudden mechanical force. Torsion, tension, something giving way under immense pressure.
And glass breaking.
That suggests the failure of containment vessels. Mm-hmm. Maybe releasing pressure, maybe releasing volatile materials into that enclosed space.
This forensic detail is so important because it implies this massive, uncontrolled physical power without getting sensational. It's just the sound of the engineered system failing.
The racks, the vessels, the structural supports of the lab, all failing utterly under the strain of whatever was emerging. This is the moment the chaos moves from contained instability to uncontrolled systemic violence.
And Dexter's action in that moment, it speaks volumes about his obsession. The sources state he ran into the lab.
He didn't run away. He didn't flee the disaster. He ran directly toward the epicenter of the crisis.
Towards his creation, his singular life's work, which was at that moment actively destroying itself and everything around it.
It emphasizes his proximity, his direct and final interaction with the event. Maybe he was going to try one last attempt at containment. Or maybe he just needed to be the witness. The one person who saw the final failure.
He sought companionship his whole life. He was running toward the one thing that was finally engaging with her.
Even if that engagement was purely destructive.
And what he found when he got there is described in section 4.2, the creation and its form. The critical finding is that the experiment was standing.
One simple phrase, but it signifies everything. Full mobility, self-support, an active capacity for agency within that chaos.
And this is where the specific horror is documented. The description from the initial analysis is, it's devastating in how brief and clear it is.
Yeah.
Human-shaped, but wrong.
Let's focus on that. The chilling implication of that qualitative description, human-shaped.
So it physically resembled a person. It met the basic form factor he needed for his companion.
But wrong. It failed on a fundamental systemic level that defied any simple explanation. It was a structural success, but a psychological catastrophe.
The horror isn't that it had claws or fangs or something monstrous like
that. No, the horror is in the proximity. That the physical form was so chillingly close to human, but the internal system, the mental coherence, the psychological integration, the soul that Dexter was searching for was either completely absent or violently corrupted.
It achieved his physical goal, but it completely and utterly failed his companion goal.
It was a living rejection of the intellect that created it. And that realization for Dexter in that moment must have been the true horror.
And that rejection, whether it was intentional or just a consequence of its own instability, it triggered the final act.
A 4.3. The creation responded by fulfilling the chaotic implications of its own nature. The file says it destroyed everything.
Everything.
Total annihilation of the lab structure and all the physical evidence inside it. And this wasn't a generalized explosion that leaves rubble and debris. The records suggest a systemic, almost targeted destruction of the environment that contained it.
As if it was erasing its own origin story.
It's possible. It speaks to either an enormously powerful, uncontrollable force generated by its unstable nature, or, and this is a chilling thought, a nascent primal impulse for total erasure. And this final act is what guarantees the secrecy and the ambiguity of the Hillsborough Enigma.
It ensured the story could only ever be told through the negative space.
The things that were destroyed, the person who was gone, and the single object that somehow survived.
Okay, so section 5. This deals with the aftermath. The cleanup, the federal investigation.
The cold, hard facts. 5.1. The investigation and the aftermath. Investigators arrive on scene and they find total surgical annihilation. But it's localized. It's all contained beneath the house.
The scope of destruction was immense, but it didn't spread.
Right. And that total destruction means any lingering trace of Project Red Unstable chemical samples, physical remnants of other failed iterations, was pulverized, vaporized, rendered completely unrecognizable.
Which makes it an unsolved and unreplicable case.
Exactly. There is zero physical evidence of the causal event itself, only evidence of its consequences.
And then there's the crucial missing piece. The subject. Dexter was never found.
Never. This confirms that classic missing scientist trope, but with this horrifying twist of proximity. He was there. Did he flee? Was he consumed by the destruction? Was he somehow integrated into it? The case file just closes. He's gone.
And his absence, when you set it against the total destruction, that becomes the key piece of evidence, doesn't it?
It does. As we've talked about in other files, like the ones on Klaus Richter, sometimes the erasure is the evidence. Dexter's disappearance doesn't point to a successful escape. It points to the comprehensive, all-consuming nature of whatever happened in that basement.
If anything else could have survived, why not the creator?
Exactly. However, the annihilation wasn't 100% absolute. Section 5.2 forces us to focus on the single artifact that was recovered intact, Dexter's personal scientific notebook.
Which is just. Oh. It's incredible. In a scene where solid metal was snapped and reinforced glass was shattered, why did this one object made of paper and thread survive?
It's the silent witness. Its survival is a statistical anomaly. Maybe it was in a desk that collapsed in a certain way or a container shielded it. We don't know. But its survival means everything.
It outlived the creator and the creation.
Making it the one verifiable first-person record of the entire case, it's the Rosetta Stone of the Hillsborough Laboratory.
It really echoes that investigative maxim, doesn't it? Artifacts outlive their makers.
It does. The lab is gone, Dexter is gone, the physical evidence is erased. But the final, precise record of his failure remains.
And that record leads us right to 5.3, decoding the final entry. The very last page of that notebook.
It contains what we have to consider the conclusive summary of the entire case, written in Dexter's own hand, and we have to presume it was written right before, or maybe even during, the chaos of that night.
The entry, recovered completely intact, reads exactly, "Red, projected failure."
Let's do a full textual analysis of that. Three parts, Project Red.
Okay, that's confirmed. The code name for the synthetic life endeavor.
Then ED. The designation ED is curious. Given the history, the failures that piled up, it most likely stands for addition, the final version, the ultimate, most complete attempt.
So the thing he saw standing in the lab.
Yeah.
That was the culmination of his life's work.
It was. And then the final word, stamped with this definitive capital F emphasis, failure.
A profound singular verdict.
That one word just encapsulates everything. The years of accelerated intellect, the burden of his genius, the secret lab, the repeated unstable life forms, all of it reduced to a single devastating judgment.
It's the last documented message from the creator acknowledging the total comprehensive failure of his life's work.
It suggests he recognized in that final moment that the experiment, by standing up and destroying everything, proved conclusively that it was not the intellectual companion he so desperately sought.
The failure wasn't just scientific. It wasn't a calculation error.
No, it was a devastating philosophical rejection of his core thesis. He failed to solve his personal crisis through scientific application.
And the ultimate physical result of all of this, 5.4, is the official conclusion that cemented this place as an enigma.
The lab was sealed and quarantined by federal order.
A permanent physical barrier placed over the site of destruction. That's not a cleanup operation.
No, it's containment. It solidifies the location as a place of extreme, unquantifiable hazard. It's an official admission that whatever happened down there was beyond the scope of any standard investigation to safely handle or remediate.
The act of sealing it ensures no one else goes looking. No further study, no further recovery, and no chance for replication.
The enigma, the core unanswered question of Project Red, remains preserved beneath that federal seal, waiting for us to piece together the events from the fragments left behind.
This has been an intensely detailed journey through an extraordinarily accelerated and ultimately tragic life.
It really has.
To synthesize what we've found for you, we've tracked Dexter from his anomalous birth in 1986 through his isolating intellectual speed, all the way to that singular, all-consuming drive for companionship.
And that drive fueled the chaotic, secretive life experimentation in that basement lab. It resulted in repeated, unstable failures, and it all culminated in that single final night of violent response.
The evidence trail is really defined by what's missing, what was destroyed, and what vanished.
We have the sound of metal snapping and glass breaking, which signifies massive, uncontrolled force. We have the description of the entity as human-shaped but wrong, confirming its morphological success but its profound psychological failure.
And we have that final definitive stamp of failure in the creator's own notebook.
But the records, because they're so incomplete, they leave this enormous vacuum of information.
We don't know the exact nature of the destructive force that erased the lab. We don't know where Dexter ran to, assuming he even could run.
And most importantly, if the entity destroyed everything, if it was the epicenter of this total systemic collapse, what happened to the anomaly itself? What happened to the creation that was human-shaped but wrong?
The thing the sources confirmed was inherently unstable and destructive, Where did it go?
This is where we have to connect the available evidence and ask the final difficult question. We know the experiment stood up. We know it possessed vast kinetic power. It destroyed the lab completely, and it was inherently unstable. We also know definitively that Dexter ran into the destruction and was never, ever recovered.
The creator and the creation were last seen together at the epicenter of the annihilation.
Exactly. And building on the evidence that the creation was a perfect physical form, but a severe psychological failure. And considering its profound, destructive final act, we have to address the ultimate ambiguity of the case.
Which is?
If the Project Red failure just destroyed the creator in the lab, how did the destructive entity, this massive source of instability and force, disappear? Why was there no trace of its own dissolution? No evidence of its containment failing and it escaping into the world?
The only thing Dexter ever wanted was not to be alone.
Exactly. Given that the only thing he ever truly desired was companionship, and given that the creation was capable of destroying everything in that lab and Dexter was never recovered, we are left with this chilling paradox.
Did the Project Red failure merely destroy its creator?
Or did the creation, in its final, massive, destructive act, successfully achieve the goal of companionship in the only way its unstable nature allowed? Did Dexter disappear because he fled the entity? Or did he become a necessary, final, and permanent part of it? That is the lasting truth of the Hillsborough Enigma that remains sealed beneath the surface.